This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and when I start my workday, it always begins with that morning shower. Normally, I use a liquid body wash, but recently I purchased a bar of Sterling Soap Company's handcrafted bath soap and decided to give their Deep Blue Sea handcrafted bath soap a try. Immediately, the aroma of Sterling's bath soap was obvious, and in using this soap, I felt refreshed, clean, energized, and Sterling's bath soap helped me step out of that shower with the momentum and eagerness to get my day rolling. If you want to get a refreshing wake-up call in the morning and get your busy day off to the right start, I highly recommend going to Sterling Soap Company's website and order one of their many varieties of bath soaps among other products they offer. Visit Sterling Soap Company at sterlingsoap.com. That's STIRLINGsoap.com.
This is Steve Fidel, former linebacker for the University of Pittsburgh Panthers and the Pittsburgh Steelers, and you're listening to the Total Sports Recall Podcast, a part of the Sports History Network. Now here's your host, Harv Aronson.
Welcome to the Total Sports Recall Podcast. I am your host, Harv Aronson, and on this episode, I'd like to talk about cities across America that have professional and amateur sports teams, which obviously are all well known by the team's name. Call them nicknames if you will, but within the rosters that make up those teams, sometimes there are more nicknames given to certain phases or positions of those teams, and sometimes just labeled on several or more athletes on the team. I've compiled a long list, but there are many more that won't be mentioned. However, this list of 50, I'm sure, will be recognized or remembered by sports fans everywhere. The nicknames on the list come from the National Football League and Major College Football, Major League Baseball, the National Hockey League, and College and Pro Basketball. As I hail from the great city of Pittsburgh, host of this year's NFL Draft, what better way to start this list with not just football, but one of the most iconic nicknames in all of sports that belong to my team, the Steelers, the Steel Curtain. Most Steeler fans can immediately name the front four of the 1970s Steelers that made up the Steel Curtain: Joe Green, Dwight White, Elsie Greenwood, and Ernie Holmes. Three of them had well-known nicknames, with Mean Joe Green, Hollywood Bags, Elsie Greenwood, and Arrowhead, Ernie Holmes. What they brought to opposing offenses was sheer terror. Trying to run on this front four was nearly impossible. Quarterbacks on the other sides shuddered at the thought of these four men coming at them. Later, the Steel Curtain became known to represent the rest of the defense, which became one of the best in history. Players behind the front line included perhaps one of the best trio of linebackers ever, with Jack Lambert, Jack Ham, and Andy Russell, for the most part, making up that unit. Then in the secondary, there was hard-hitting Mel Blunt, and safeties Mike Wagner and Donnie Shell, who was also a dominating special teams player. The other cornerback was JT Thomas. Of this group, Green, Lambert, Ham, Blunt, and Shell are all inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and certainly Elsie Greenwood belongs there, but keeps getting shut out year after year. With 28 football teams on this list, the question is, where do I go next? How about another defensive front that was one to be feared? That would be the fearsome foursome. A decade before the Steel Curtain became a household name, the Los Angeles Rams had a front four that was nearly as dangerous as the Steelers' group of players. The fearsome foursome was made up of Deacon Jones, Merlin Olsen, Rosie Greer, and Lamar Lundy. Jones was easily the best of the four and about as scary as was Joe Green. Jones became known by the nickname Secretary of Defense, and with his ability to sack the quarterback, he's credited with the NFL beginning to record sacks. Olsen made 14 Pro Bowls in his career and became a successful announcer. Rosie Greer, I remember for being in the B movie, The Thing with Two Heads. If you want a good laugh, check out that movie. Greer was also known for his knitting abilities. The last of the group was Lundy, who would finish with 16.5 sacks in his 13 seasons all with the Rams. While on the topic of football and the number 4, I next bring you the 4 horsemen. Then we switch gears and we go to college football and the legendary school Notre Dame to give you an offensive unit that became known as the 4 horsemen. They were Harry Stuhl Dreher, the quarterback of the 1924 Fighting Irish squad, with Don Miller at his right halfback and Jim Crowley, the left halfback. Elmer Layden, the fullback. With legendary head coach Newt Rockne leading the team, the Irish went 10-0 that season and won the national championship. Sports writer Grant Lynn Rice, a legend as well in the journalism field, came up with the nickname. It was derived by Rice after Notre Dame pulled off a 13-7 victory over favored Army on October 18th of that year. All 4 of the horsemen have been inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame. None of the 4 went into the NFL, but did go into coaching and administrative careers in the sport. The Dallas Cowboys have been a franchise since 1960, with Tom Landry, their longest tenured coach, from their first year until he was fired in 1988. He is in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, but was there when the reference to the Cowboys became known as America's Team. The creator of this nickname was Bobby Ryan, who produced Dallas' 1978 highlight film and the narration for the special opened with this. They appear on television so often that their faces are similar to the public as presidents and movie stars. They are the Dallas Cowboys, America's Team. When you ask some of the old Pittsburgh Steelers players about the Cowboys label, they have immediate reaction. That seems natural since in Super Bowl X and Super Bowl XIII, Pittsburgh defeated Dallas. After the Super Bowl X victory, the NFL commissioner Pete Rozelle said the Steelers could have the nickname since they won. But the Steelers owner at the time, Art Rooney Sr., rejected the offer. He is quoted as responding to Rozelle with, "We are not America's team. We are the Pittsburgh Steelers." With the rejection, Dallas held on to the label. Steelers great Mel Blunt added fuel to that fire with, "They're not America's team. We're going to show them who America's team is. We're the team. We were fired up because they got all the publicity like they do now, but they don't win in the playoffs." Additionally, players in Steelers Nation reject the notion as well because, as Steelers faithful know, the Steelers have a fan base that is worldwide and probably the largest fan base in any sport, while according to many, the Cowboys are more of a national brand. With all this said, I would in no way discredit the Cowboys. They have been an outstanding franchise, and I contend that if not for the Steelers' domination in the 1970s, it would have been the Cowboys winning multiple Super Bowls and not Pittsburgh. While I've spoken so far about 3 great teams thus far, the next nickname is quite the opposite. While the Cincinnati Bengals have had some particularly good seasons and even made it to the Super Bowl twice only to lose, there was a period in their history when their team played very poorly. Interestingly enough, the term Bungles was derived from none other than famed Steelers color man and broadcaster Myron Cope. The reason he came up with it is because the Bengals had gone through a period of ineptness and were one of the worst teams in the league. After the 1990 season concluded, Cincinnati spent the next 14 years without getting to the postseason. In that span, they hired and fired head coaches, and their top draft picks turned out to be failures. The Pittsburgh Steelers not only had the steel curtain in the 70s, but in the 1990s, with Dick LeBeau as the defensive coordinator, his unit became known as Blitzburg. This as a result of LeBeau's zone blitz schemes. Pittsburgh's defense in that decade might be one of their best ever, aside from the 1970s players. And in the 1990s, the defense included such great players as Greg Lloyd, Kevin Green, LaVon Kirkland, Rod Woodson, and Carnell Lake. Backing them up were Chad Brown, Hardy Nickerson, and Jason Gilden. Darren Perry was a particularly good safety, as was Willie Williams. Joel Steed was a run-stuffing nose tackle, and up front, Keith Gillis was a force to be reckoned with. Brenton Buckner also came in well as a run-stuffer. While I spoke of the Cincinnati Bungles, there's another NFL team that has gone through an awful period, but instead of players on the team taking on a derogatory term or being labeled, it was the fans that came up with the nickname. The team is the New Orleans Saints, and their team was so pathetic and losing at will, the fans turned to putting brown paper bags over their heads and calling themselves the Aints. The height of the Aints fan base came in 1980 when New Orleans lost their first 14 games. Mentioned before were some great defensive units, but there are more. How about the doomsday defense in Dallas? Here are some of the more well-known players from that defense: Jethro Pugh, Bob Lilly, Chuck Howley, Leroy Jordan, Mel Renfro, Herb Adderley, and Cliff Harris. Then there is the group that made up the Monsters of the Midway that resurfaced for the 1985 Chicago Bears, perhaps the greatest one-season team in NFL history. But the origin of the name actually dates way back to the University of Chicago and their team, the Maroons. The nickname referenced the Midway placements on Chicago's south side, and the Bears adopted the moniker more so because of the fact that the Chicago Bears won six NFL titles between 1932 and 1946. But when the Bears won the Super Bowl in 1985, winning every game but one, and they lost to Miami Dolphins on Monday Night Football, that 1985 defense was downright dominating, and who can forget William the Refrigerator Perry going from defense to the offensive backfield and scoring a touchdown in that Super Bowl. The defense was powered by Richard Dent, Dan Hampton, Dave Durison, Steve McMichael, Perry, Leslie Frazier, Gary Fensick, and Orson Wilson. Then, of course, there was the infamous Super Bowl Shuffle video, which if you haven't seen, you must go to YouTube and watch it. Take a listen to it here. We are the Bears, shuffling crew, shuffling on down, doing it for you. We're so bad, we know we're good, blowing your mind like we knew we would. You know we're just strutting for fun, strutting our stuff for everyone. We're not here to start no trouble, we're just here to do the Super Bowl show. Well, they call me Sweetness, and I like to dance. Running the ball is like Mickey Moe Mance. We had the goal since training camp to give Chicago a Super Bowl champ. And we're not doing this because we're greedy. The Bears are doing it to feed the needy. We didn't come here to look for trouble. We just come here to do the Super Bowl shot.
This is Speedy Willie, and I'm world class. I like running, but I love to get the pass. I practice all day and dance all night. I gotta get ready for the Sunday fight. Now, I'm as smooth as a chocolate swirl. I dance a little funky, so watch me, girl. There's no one here that doesn't like me. My Super Bowl Shuffle will set you free.
I'm Samurai Mike. I snap, I'm cold. Part of the defense, big and bold. I've been jamming for quite a while, doing what's right and setting the style. Give me a chance, I'll rock you good. Nobody messing in my neighborhood. I didn't come here looking for trouble. I just came to do the Super Bowl Shuffle.
We are the Bears, shuffling crew, shuffling on down, doing it for you. We're so bad, we know we're good, blowing your mind like a new year's foot. You know we're just strutting for fun, strutting our stuff for everyone. We're not here to start no trouble, we're just here to do the Super Bowl Shuffle.
The Legion of Boom. Now, this is a great nickname. Around the year 2010, the Seattle Seahawks had an excellent defense and played a big part in their success. The defensive players that made up that Legion are in part Richard Sherman, Earl Thomas, Cam Chancellor, Brandon Browner, Walter Thurman, and Byron Maxwell. Then added to the Boom later were Bobby Wagner, Cliff Averill, and Michael Bennett, among others. The Legion of Boom era ran from 2011 through the 2018 season, and in that time, Seattle had six straight winning campaigns that included three division titles and two NFC titles, which led to one Super Bowl victory. While they had names, this defense was known as the No Name Defense. The 1972 Miami Dolphins are the only team in NFL history to finish the season undefeated, then run all the way to the Super Bowl, winning it and finishing an entire season unbeaten. The No Names on this unit were Nick Bonacani, Manny Fernandez, Verdan Herden, and Jake Scott and Dick Anderson, just to name a few of them. I still have more football nicknames to cover, and I'll go next with another defensive unit. A very catchy nickname out there in Minnesota, the Purple People Eaters, who were a very lethal unit. And they were the defensive front for the Minnesota Vikings. This was from the 1960s and 1970s era, that featured on the defensive line the likes of Carl Ellis, Alan Page, Jim Marshall, and Gary Larson. They would later add the tag, Meet at the Quarterback, for their MO. The nickname came from the 1958 song by Chev Woolley. I have yet another nickname defense that is historic, and more so because of one tremendous linebacker. Perhaps the greatest linebacker in the history of the NFL was Lawrence Taylor. As a part of the 1980s New York Giants defense, that unit became known as Big Blue Wrecking Crew. Led by Taylor, this was a vicious defense that hit hard. Just ask Joe Theismann, who was on the wrong end of a Taylor hit that resulted in a terribly broken leg for Joe Theismann. Taylor's partners in crime-stopping offenses included Carl Banks, Harry Carson, Leonard Marshall, and Jim Burke. The Giants had their wrecking crew in the NFC, but in the same era in the AFC were the combination of Mark Gastineau, Joe Klecko, Marty Lyons, and Abdul Salam, as the quartet was wreaking havoc on opposing quarterbacks and got tabbed with the nickname the New York Sack Exchange. Of course, they were all playing for the Jets. The nickname Killer Bees actually belonged to two teams. First, it was the start of the 1980s that the Miami Dolphins defense had playing for them Bob Baumhauer, Doug Betters, Kim Bocamper, Glenn Blackwood, Lyle Blackwood, Bob Brudzinski, and Charles Bowser. Six players, all with the last names beginning with the letter B. Offensively, for five seasons, the Pittsburgh Steelers had a trio that was highly productive. Three players with last names beginning with that same letter. They were Ben Roethlisberger, Antonio Brown, and Le'Veon Bell. Another offense earned a nickname in the latter part of the 70s and into the early 1980s, and it was the San Diego Chargers offense that we're talking about and was led by Hall of Fame quarterback Dan Fouts. Coach Don Coryell came up with a system that utilized a vertical passing game, and it became known as Air Coryell. College football teams have had their share of nicknames, and the Fordham University, similar to Notre Dame's Four Horsemen, had their own group of players known by a catchy nickname. Fordham had their seven blocks of granite, referring to their offensive line, which was composed of Leon Paquin, Johnny Drews, Alex Wojciechowicz, Ed Franco, Al Barbarski, Mike Purcell, and Harry Jasinski. They were backed up by Natty Pierce and Vince Lombardi, that same man who the Super Bowl trophy was named after. Back in the NFL, another defense in the same era as the aforementioned Giants and Jets was the Denver Broncos. Their mighty defense labeled the Orange Crush. Sporting orange colors for their jerseys, former team by play-by-play man Woody Page came up with the nickname, referring in particular to defensive players Tom Jackson, Randy Gradishar, Paul Smith, Barney Chavez, Lyle Alzado, Reuben Carter, Bob Swenson, Joe Rizzo, Billy Thompson, Lewis Wright, Steve Foley, and Bernard Jackson. In 1977, the team finished 12-2, reached the Super Bowl, only to lose to the Dallas Cowboys. The Washington Redskins actually owned two nicknames. In 1982, the head coach in Washington was Joe Bugle. He had built a formidable offensive line that would be nicknamed the Hogs. The original line was made up of center Jeff Bostic, guards Russ Grimm, Mark May, and tackles Joe Jacoby and George Stark. Partnering up with the rest of the team, the Redskins made the Super Bowl four times, winning three Lombardis from 1982 through 1991. Stemming from the Hogs came the Hoggettes. Because of the Visa Hall of Fans Award I won, and then traveling to the Football Hall of Fame, I was fortunate enough to meet the originator of the Hoggettes. That was Michael Torbert. And in 1983, while visiting his grandmother's retirement home, he came dressed in one of her dresses, and his appearance went over incredibly in a positive way. So thus, the Hoggettes became a reality. It would be 30 years of fundraising and charity work until Torbert retired the group in 2012. The second nickname labeled on the Redskins was the Over the Hill Gang. This dates back to the 1970s when George Allen was the head coach, and because of a large number of veteran players on the team, they were dubbed the Over the Hill Gang. 1971 is the year credited to the origin of the nickname, and Allen used his first five draft picks as trade baits and saved only one. One of the trades brought in veteran quarterback Billy Kilmer. Through trades, he would add Jack Pardee, Byron Potios, Maxie Vaughn, Dyron Talbert, Jalen Wilbur, Jeff Jordan, Boyd Dowler, Richie Puttabon, Ron McDowell, and Rosie Taylor. I want to go back to my Pittsburgh Steelers. While I mentioned the Steel Curtain, there are nicknames created by the fans involving the fans. There are several in particular and were recognizable by the banners hanging around Three River Stadium back in the day. We had Franco's Italian Army, a legion of fans that paid tribute to the late, great Franco Harris and his Italian heritage. But if you were in Three River Stadium, you may have seen the banner that said Lambert's Lunatics, an obvious tribute to the greatest linebacker in Steelers history, Jack Lambert. There was also Jarella's Gorillas for kicker Roy Jarella, and the banner that showed the words Dobra Shanka, which in the Polish language means good ham. In Slavic, it's defined as great ham, and this was an obvious reference to another great linebacker, Jack Ham. Enough football talk now. What about the great sport of baseball? Where do I begin? Naturally, I'll start with the Pittsburgh Pirates. Much like Franco's Italian Arm and the other fans that had nicknames for players on the team, the Pirates many years ago had two brothers playing for them, Paul and Lloyd Wehner, better known by their nicknames, Big Poison and Little Poison, Paul owning the big name. In the 1970s, the Pirates were winning the 1971 World Series, and they were tabbed with the nickname the Lumber Company. Key players who contributed to that moniker were Willie Stargell, Roberto Clemente, Bob Robertson, Al Oliver, Richie Hebner, and Manny Sanguin. And that happens to be my favorite team of all time, that 1971 squad. Another nickname that belonged to the Pirates was the Battling Bucks. This dates back to 1925 when the team won the World Series then, and Pittsburgh's baseball team has also been called the Buckos. Perhaps the greatest team in Major League Baseball history are the 1927 New York Yankees. Now, most baseball fans know that their lineup that year became known as Murderer's Row. How powerful a lineup that explains the nickname. The main core of that starting nine were Earl Combs, Mark Henning, Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Bob Musial, and Tony Lazzari. Together with their teammates, they posted a team batting average of .307, scored close to 1,000 runs, and smashed 158 home runs. This team would win 110 games, losing only 43, and sweeping the Pittsburgh Pirates in the World Series 4-0. Another great baseball team that I was fortunate enough to witness was the 1975 Cincinnati Reds, also known as the Big Red Machine. They too had a formidable lineup. The starting nine had three players eventually inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame and one that belongs there. Their lineup was scary. Johnny Bench, Tony Perez, Joe Morgan, Dave Concepcion, Pete Rose, and George Foster, Cesar Geronimo, and Ken Griffey Sr. The Reds won a classic World Series title defeating the Boston Red Sox and would win it again the following season. In 1975, the team won 105 games. In 1934, the St. Louis Cardinals won the World Series. Their roster included a ragtag group of players that threw caution to the wind and went out and just simply played baseball with utter determination. That earned them the nickname the Gas House Gang. This group of players had a reputation of not worrying about appearances and were thought to be unkempt in their appearance, thus the nickname. But they had some great players taking the field. That included Dizzy Dean and his brother Paul Daffy Dean, as well as the rough-going Pepper Martin, Frankie Frisch, Joe Ducky Medwick, and Ripper Collins. After winning 95 games that season, they upended the Detroit Tigers in the World Series. The year was 1969, and the New York Mets found themselves 5 games behind on September 1st. Then they began a furious charge towards the first-place Chicago Cubs. In their final 30 games, the Mets won 23. They played the Cubs the final 2 games of the season, but by October 2nd, the division had been won by the Miracle Mets. That was their nickname, Miracle Mets. And that is what they were called for because of that incredible comeback. They would go on to defeat the Atlanta Braves in the National League Championship Series and in 5 games, knock off the Baltimore Orioles for their first World Series title in history. Just 7 years earlier in their very first season in the league, the Mets had won just 40 games while losing 120, setting a new modern-day record for losses in a season up to that point. Their first baseman in 1962 was Marv Throneberry, who became the butt of jokes because of his terrible fielding abilities. A black eye for Major League Baseball came in 1919 in what has become known as the Black Sox scandal. The Black Sox were the Chicago White Sox who got caught throwing the World Series to the Cincinnati Reds for money to the mafia. The series of events led to the filming of the movie 8 Men Out, showcasing the fact that 8 of the White Sox players were thrown out of baseball permanently. One of those 8 was Shoeless Joe Jackson, one of the greatest players ever, but was far less involved than the other 8 who got the boot from the sport they had loved. And that would be the other 7, so he was the 8th player, but he got thrown out of baseball as well. In a more positive situation were the Boys of Summer. This was the Brooklyn Dodgers, who in the 1950s are attributed for breaking the color barrier in baseball with the signing of Jackie Robinson. The Dodgers in that era had made World Series several times and were one of baseball's best teams. The moniker also prompted famous writer Roger Pond to pen a book titled by the same name. The Dodgers had the great Robinson on the team, but also Duke Snider and Pee Wee Reese. Brooklyn won the World Series in 1955, but after losing five times prior since 1947. Hall of Fame manager Walt Austin led the squad, but more stars were on the team, including Roy Campanella, who had his career cut short tragically after a car accident left him paralyzed. Two Carls were on that team, Fiorillo and Erskine. Also on the roster was future Dodgers manager Tommy Lasorda, and Los Angeles had an amazing pitching staff. Taking that mound yet that year was one of the greatest pitchers in the history, Sandy Koufax. The staff was also bolstered with Don Newcomb and Clem Labine. Now, staying in baseball, we go to the year 1950 and the Philadelphia Phillies, who won the National League pennant with a roster of players, and an average age on that team was just 26.4 years. Thus, given their their nickname, the Whiz Kids, based on the success that they had, and it was slapped on them. It took until the final day of that season for the Phillies to win the pennant, their first since 1915. They would get swept by the New York Yankees in the World Series that season, but there were some exceptionally good players on that team, including Robin Roberts, Richie Ashburn, and Jim Constantine. From the young 1950 Phillies to a team that could not hit, I give you the Hitless Wonders. That was the nickname of the Chicago White Sox of 1906, who as a team finished the season with a league low batting average of just .230. But with a pitching staff that posted a team ERA of 2.13, and on the strength of a 19-game winning streak, the White Sox streaked to the World Series, beating crosstown rivals, the Cubs, in six games to win the baseball's biggest prize. Adding more fuel to the fire was the nickname is the fact that the White Sox as a team had only hit seven home runs all season. There are just four nicknames I'd like to mention, and they are all from basketball. Looking back at the history of the Olympic Games, it used to be only amateur athletes could represent their respective countries. But the day finally arrived that professional athletes could compete. That turned into a complete nightmare for countries other than the United States when the Dream Team took part in the 1992 Summer Olympic Games. And not only did the United States win the gold medal, but the cast of pros all absolutely demolished opposing teams, taking home the top prize by winning games on an average margin of 44 points. The American roster was built with a team of players that ensured no other country's team would come close to even competing with them. Here was your dream team: Charles Barkley, Larry Bird, Clyde Drexler, Patrick Ewing, Magic Johnson, Michael Jordan, Christian Laettner, Karl Malone, Chris Mullin, Scottie Pippen, David Robinson, and John Stockton. The head coach was Chuck Daly, and the 1992 Olympics presented the first time NBA players were allowed to compete. Not only did the team win all eight games they played, but they won every contest by 30 or more points. 11 of the 12 players on that team landed in the Basketball Hall of Fame. In college basketball, we had the Fab Five. This was the University of Michigan Wolverines and their 1991 squad that had five freshman starters who took the team to back-to-back NCAA titles, but lost both. Head coach Steve Fisher's starters were Chris Webber, Jalen Rose, Juwan Howard, Jimmy King, and Ray Jackson. They caught the public's eye by wearing baggy shorts, black socks, and played more of a street ball style. Four of the five ended up in the NBA: Webber, Howard, Rose, and King. Also in college basketball was Phi Slammajama. The basketball seasons we were talking about are from 1981 through 1984, and it was the University of Houston, led by coach Guy Lewis, who put on a display of high-flying and constant dunking on the court by these players. Stars of the team were Hakeem Olajuwon and Clyde Drexler, and in three straight years, the team made the Final Four of the NCAA March Madness tournament. Finally, we turn to the National Hockey League and one of the most brutal teams in history. That would be the Philadelphia Flyers and their rough and tough Broadway Street Bullies. The nickname derived from the writers Jack Chevalier and Peter Capone, who were employed by the Philadelphia Bulletin, and on January 3, 1973, the Flyers had beaten the Atlantic Flames in a game that was marred with some brawling on the ice. In Chevalier's article recapping the game, he wrote, "The image of the fighting Flyers spreading gradually around the NHL, and people are dreaming up wild nicknames. They're the Mean Machine, the Bullies of Broad Street, and Freddy's Philistines. Then Caffone added the headline, Broad Street Bullies Muscle Atlanta. The team was led by Captain and Center Bobby Clark, and on his left wing was the bruising Dave Schultz, who never turned away from an on-ice fight. This team would advance to the Stanley Cup Finals, where they lost to the Montreal Canadiens. There are nicknames on my original list, but I did not mention, so without explaining them, here they are. The Atlanta Falcons, Dirty Birds. The New York Jets had Gang Green. Cleveland Browns, the Cardiac Kids. SMU football, Pony Express. The Washington Redskins also had the Fun Bunch. Los Angeles Rams put on their greatest show on turf. The Buffalo Sabres had the French Connection. New York Yankees, of course, we know them as the Bronx Bombers. The Oakland A's had a couple of guys on the team. They called themselves the Bash Brothers. The Philadelphia Phillies had a couple of other pitchers, the Nasty Boys. And finally, the Detroit Pistons with Bill Laimbeer, the Bad Boys. And there you have it, some of the most famous and well-remembered nicknames. And if I missed on some of them, or you remember others, feel free to email me and let me know at the show's official email address, totalsportsrecall@gmail.com. At the end of this month, my next podcast will come at you, and the topic is going to be boxers from my home city of Pittsburgh and some of the fights they had at the old Forbes Field, which was not only host to the Pittsburgh Pirates and Steelers, but also other events like professional boxing. I hope you enjoyed this bit of trivial episode, and all comments and suggestions are always welcome using the email address just previously mentioned. As always, much thanks go out to the Sports History Network. And until the next episode, this is Harv Aronson wishing everyone good health and high spirits.
The contents of this podcast do not represent the opinions of others and are solely the opinions of Harv Aronson based on his experience, knowledge, and research.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, aka the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you gotta do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.